our identity leads our activity. So even if it's that thing that you want, so for me, it was to be on the World Cup team so that I could make an Olympic team. If your identity doesn't match that, you will end up having actions and activity that doesn't align with that. So whether that's a self-sabotaging thing or you just decide like, okay, my routines don't matter anymore and I'm just not going to adhere to these things, or you make choices that are not in alignment with the thing that you want. And that has to do with the identity that you're holding.
Hello, and welcome to Pursuing Health. I'm Dr. Julie Fouché, family physician and former CrossFit Games athlete. Here, I bring you information and inspiration to help bridge the gap between fitness and medicine and support your journey toward your healthiest self. Thank you so much for joining me. Now let's get started with this week's episode.
Welcome back to Pursuing Health. I am excited to be here today with Megan Henry, who also has the awesome nickname of the Savage Meglet. I'm excited to hear more about where that came from. But she's really a force. She is known for her grit, her determination, resilience, and perseverance. She is a lifelong athlete. She played 2 Division I sports, field hockey and track. And she had her sights set on her next athletic pursuit, which was just a calm 80 mile per hour sled ride with 5 G's of force going head first with your chin off the ice, otherwise known as skeleton, where she represented Team USA, as well as the Army World-Class Athlete Program for over a decade. Her dreams were temporarily put on hold when she was diagnosed with a life-threatening blood clot and was told she would never be an athlete again. But of course, she never gives up. So she chose to tell a different story. I'm excited to hear all about that time period. And she battled back to become a multiple world championship team member, a 2-time track record holder, and was ranked as high as 8th in the world. She was also the fastest pusher in the United States and number 1 in the U.S. for many years, as well as a 2022 Olympic alternate. And now Megan is pursuing performance and mindset coaching, where she helps athletes harness their inner power by changing the story they tell themselves and harnessing the power of consistency and habits. So welcome, Megan. I'm so excited to hear about your story and just chat about all the things. So thank you for joining me.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, I think we should just start with, obviously, you are an athlete. Through all around. And so I'd love to know where that came from. You know, where did your love for sports and competition come from? And how was that nurtured from a young age, then going into collegiate athlete?
That's a great question. I think it's twofold, right? So my dad was actually an amazing athlete. He went to school at LSU and played football there. He ended up having a career-ending injury, but I mean, that's where my athleticism comes from, is my father. And so he nurtured that because he kind of lived vicariously through my brother and I and pushed us towards sports. So a bit of it was, yes, that nurturing aspect. I obviously was gifted with athletic talents. But I do think there's a natural piece to it that I just love competing. I love training for something. Mm-hmm. And having a goal to reach for, and which is ironic because when I was really young, I was super, super shy. And so for me to be a very competitive person, it's like an alter ego, I guess.
So I love that.
But I've played sports my whole life. I played field hockey in college and I ran track in college. And those were my 2 main sports that I played, like from middle school on. Those were my focus sports. And I just, skeleton truly fell into my lap. I was about to graduate. I was joining the Army after I graduated from college. And then I was recruited to try bobsled. Okay. And I'm small in stature. I know you're pretty small in stature as well, but I'm 5'2".
Okay, you've got me by a couple inches then.
120 pounds at most. And bobsledders are usually a bit bigger. They're like 5'8", can be 160 plus pounds. And so I went and I tried bobsled, but naturally I was like, this isn't going to work out because they're like...
You need a little more mass.
Yeah, you need to put on 30 to 50 pounds. I was like, okay, I can barely put on 10 pounds in a clean way unless I'm sitting around eating chocolate cake all day. So I switched over to skeleton, and I found out through my head coach that there's the Army World Class Athlete Program. So if you are on a national team for any sport in the US and you have the potential mm-hmm. to make an Olympic team, you can apply to the Army World Class Athlete Program and represent the Army. And so ended up working out that I got accepted to do that. And wow. so I represented the Army and the US at the same time for many years.
That is and so cool.
Yeah, it was really, really awesome. And I absolutely loved that. I'm recently retired. I retired from competing from skeleton last season after the Olympic Games. And I still have that though. I say that, you know, we come to Earth with different desires and skills mm-hmm. and talents. And that happened to be mine. Mine was to, you know, shine my light and my passion and inspire and help others through sport. And initially it was me competing, and now it's transitioned mm-hmm. to the mindset aspect.
I just love that. I love that. I'm so curious about one, your decision to go into the Army after college. And then two, this recruitment process to skeleton, because I feel like, or I guess bobsled initially, I feel like I've heard of other track athletes then going on to do one of those winter sports. And so, you know, it makes me wonder, what did you do in track? And then what are the recruiters looking for in athletes for those particular sports?
Sure. So I'll answer the first question. I always had an interest in joining the military, even when I was really young. I remember that there was my middle school and high school were attached, and then there was the recruiters came into the school mm-hmm. and they were seeking to talk to the high schoolers, but they were doing a push-up contest. And so I went over and I was like, I'm going to be in this push-up contest.
I'm going to join that.
And yes. I'm going to win.
And so I love that.
They're like,
I
okay.
can so relate, because being in a, you know, even elementary school, middle school, being a female who could do push-ups and pull-ups for the presidential fitness test. Right. I was always a gymnast growing up. So I was one of the few girls who could actually do them. And I can see that competitive edge coming out too.
Definitely. So in order to participate, you had to put your name on a sheet of paper. And I was like, okay, yeah, sure, whatever. So this recruiter, mind you, I was probably 12 or 13 at the time. This recruiter mm-hmm. used that information, comes to our house, and my dad opens the door and he's like, hello, like, can I help you? He's like, I'm looking for Megan. And he's like, Megan is not old enough to join the Army. But he came in and talked to me anyway and told me, you know, what my options were, what kind of jobs there were. And that stuck with me. So when I was going through college, I could have gone through ROTC, but just the commitment with sports was too much. So I was like, no. Mm-hmm. But
already doing two sports. Yeah.
Yeah. So that stuck with me though. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to look into the Army. I wanted a federal job when I went to graduate, but they were like, you need 3 to 5 years of experience and a master's degree. And I'm like, okay, well, what are you doing at an undergrad job fair? So that's what I did. As soon as I graduated, I went home. I talked to all of the branches, but the Army just seemed to fit me the best. Mm-hmm. And I had always thought that it was an honor to serve your country. And so it just worked out that it aligned, that I was able to do something like that as well as pursue my athletic interests. You know, I wasn't quite finished in my mind of like competing after college. Mm-hmm. I'm sure a lot of athletes, I'm sure you can relate, that you're like, well, I still like doing that. I'm still capable mm-hmm. and it's just done. So it was a really just amazing blessing and opportunity. And so that's kind of my story with the Army. I'm still in the Army Reserve. I am a captain mm-hmm. and I'm going to school full time for sports psychology right now. And I hope to graduate in September. And then to answer your other question about the recruitment process. So the US is a little bit behind compared to other countries.
Okay.
When it comes to like winter sliding sports, we don't have quite recruitment down. Financial resources aren't the same. So we tend to pull from other power and explosive sports. Mm-hmm. And it usually comes at the college age. We've like made some strides in recruiting younger and younger people, because that's what, you know, countries in Europe are doing. They start mm-hmm. when they're like 7 years old. So there's that. We've actually had a bunch of CrossFit athletes, Colleen Fosh, for example, Tia Claire Toomey, another one. There's a bunch of CrossFit athletes who've transitioned into the bobsled space as well as skeleton, but those girls are big and strong. So they're really good for bobsled. And so that's usually like the recruitment. That's how it comes in. So I was recruited from, Alana Myers Taylor. She's a multiple Olympic medalist in bobsled. And she went to school at George Mason, I believe. And so she was contacting schools in close proximity, just like their strength and conditioning coaches. So she reached out to my strength and conditioning coach, who then came to me and was like, hey, I think you'd be a good fit for something like this. And so then I just went and went to a tryout and I...
You're like, oh, sweet, this is fun. So cool. And what events did you do in track and field?
I was a sprinter, so 100, 200, 4x1, long jump on occasion. But
I am,
my gift is in really short distances.
Okay, that makes sense. All the power. So cool.
Yeah.
So then you get there and you're, you know, learning about bobsled and then you realize, okay, maybe I'm not a fit for this. So how did you hear about skeleton and what was your first reaction when you found? I mean, to me, it looks like the most terrifying thing ever. So what made you be like, oh yeah, this is a good idea?
I knew that I knew that I was not a good fit for bobsled based on my stature. And so, and they thought so too, but sometimes in bobsled, they keep people around to use as like sandbags. I don't mean that negatively, but they rotate through people. You got to give people rest. And so,
to help with training.
And those people who may not be, you know, the A team people, they still are helping that team get to, you know, get to the Olympics or the world championship.
It's a big team that's involved.
I didn't want to do that. So, so they actually said, you probably should look into skeleton. And I had seen it. And I mean, I really didn't even know anything about it. And somewhat of an adrenaline junkie. I had gone skydiving. I've always loved roller coasters. And I was like, okay, I can try this. I could do this. So I made that transition. And when you first start skeleton, they start you lower on the track and you just gradually work your way up. As opposed to, I think people in their minds
starting at 80 miles an hour
are like, oh my God, you just go from the top of this ice track and that's it. But you gradually work your way up.
Okay. What was your first experience like going down the track?
It was very fun. You're probably going like 30 miles an hour and your chin is off of the ice. And at first it's just, you're like, oh my gosh. And you're just taking the experience in and you don't know what you're doing at that point. So it's very much fun because you don't really have any idea what's going on. And it's just the experience. You're just taking in like, okay, this is where this corner is. And this is the direction that the track goes. So it's just accumulating information and the overall experience. It was just so fun. The first time was absolutely mind blowing. It was just really, really fun.
So cool. And then, you know, I know you obviously have become very passionate about the mental side of training through your own experience and now helping others, but obviously this has been a part of sports your entire life, but it seems like some challenges that you had in skeleton really allowed you to put more focus on this side of training. So can you share, like, when did you realize, wow, I really need to start putting effort into my own mental training too?
So early on in my skeleton career, I made the realization that what I think I should be achieving is not happening. And that's because I am overanalyzing and being really perfectionistic. And so the results aren't, it's not adding up, right? And so in skeleton and in any other sport, truly, but it's really emphasized in skeleton, is that any sort of stress or tension that you have, even outside of the sport, and bring it onto your sled, it translates to your time. So you could have the perfect looking lines, your run could look fantastic, and your time is slow. And that's kind of where I was at. I was like, okay, this is really frustrating. I'm doing everything that they're telling me to do. And skeleton's also interesting because you're on the border of being out of control. Like that, the fastest is when you are super, super relaxed as can be, going headfirst 80 miles an hour. And on the border of being in and out of control, you're just on the edge. That's when that's where the magic happens.
Wow. And I can imagine so much of it, like you said, just has to do with your own being able to control your own nervous system in that situation, just for all the small details that that then impacts in terms of your speed.
Definitely. And so for me, the first thing that I really got into was mindfulness and meditation. That was the first transition I made from being, because I was, if you're a perfectionist, I'm totally different now than I was, you know, 10 years ago.
I can relate to you on that. I'm also a recovering perfectionist.
So it's very stressful to be a perfectionist.
Yes.
Very hard on yourself, very unrealistic expectations. And so I had to really modify my self-talk. That was really big, because a lot of my reactions to my results or even other people, it was pretty negative, I will say. So my self-talk is what really had to change, and my ability to focus, come back to the present, not be just dwelling on a negative experience or instance in training, and just being able to really let go and detach. And so my way of doing that really, really started from meditation. That was like the biggest shift.
I love that. And did you just know to start exploring this on your own? And where did you go first for meditation, and how did that then evolve to then working on self-talk and other things?
I had always been interested in the like Buddhism, for example, or just Zen meditation. I remember seeing a study where they had monks that were meditating, and they took sheets that were soaked in ice water, and they put them on their back, and then they would meditate, and they were able to turn the ice sheets into hot steam, and so just through the power of their mind. And so I was like, okay, if my mind has got me into this situation, it certainly can get me out.
Yeah, there you go.
So that I was like, that's what I'm going to do. I'm like, these guys know what they're doing. They've gotten,
they're doing something right.
So I just started exploring it on my own. So I actually went to some like Zen meditation practices. I went to silent meditation retreats. And then in the past few years, I've gotten really into Dr. Joe Dispenza. I've gone to a few of his retreats.
Me too. I'm such a fan.
Oh my God. Have you been to a retreat? You have to go.
I have. Yes. I went to the week-long retreat a little more than a year ago, and it was so remarkable. I think, you know, I highly recommend it. I think that you know, it's all of this stuff is out there, but I think the way that he's also bringing data and science to what he's doing is remarkable. And I think it's bringing a lot of people to meditation that otherwise would not be interested in going to like a, you know, a retreat in India or something like that.
Right. Yeah. He gives like, his scientific team is just absolutely, they're all amazing. And everything is really founded in research, and that's really helpful for people who are skeptical and think that, well, meditation is a bit too woo-woo for me.
Right.
So
and ignore data.
Right. And I mean, tapping into neuroscience and quantum mechanics and all of those, you know, very sciencey things is really cool. And he's really good at like distilling that into a way that's really easy to understand for the everyday person, which is awesome. But so that's still a practice of mine. I'm still really into meditation. Love Dr. Joe, like shout out to the OG. Then just implementing, I've like transitioned who I was working with multiple times, which I think is really good for athletes in general. I think throughout your career, you'll shift who your coach is, you get to a point where you might plateau, and so you switch and explore other options. And I think that's really important, because it helps you grow and expand and have different perspectives. And so I changed to my sports psychologist was multiple times, but I've learned really, really awesome things from all of them, and have changed my perspective over the years. But I would say there's still really like the foundational tenets that I still use with my athletes and my clients, athletes or non-athletes, mm-hmm. have to do with like the big two are self-talk and visualization. As far as like preparing for a competition, those are the two things. I still recommend some sort of mindfulness, whether that's breath work, whether that's meditation, because it develops self-awareness mm-hmm. and you're able to recognize when you're not in the present moment. And that's really important, and to be able to have the focus to come back to the present moment. But yeah, the big like two that really, really impacted my personal athletic career and the what I was able to accomplish were those two things. Those were absolutely foundational.
I love that. So meditation first to bring awareness and help you to become even aware of your self-talk. I think for so many people, for myself for many years, and it's still unraveling where I'm realizing, oh, I didn't even realize I was saying that to myself or where that was coming from. And so I think that's obviously a big part of it, but then changing the self-talk, which is really hard, especially when you have these patterns that are neurologically wired over and over again for your whole life, and visualizing yourself in a training or competition or really any setting. So how did that then shift? So what was the difference between, you know, Megan before working on all of this stuff and then Megan afterwards? How was your experience as an athlete different?
So beforehand, it was a lot of forcing and trying to get results. And when we do that, whether that's in sports or in life, you create a lot of resistance to the thing that you want. It's a lot of distance. It's very needy energy. If you want to go back to the woo-woo side of things, it's very needy sort of energy. And so it doesn't allow you to be present. And it ends up affecting how you show up physically as well. So you show up very tense. Your breathing is very shallow. And it's not conducive for peak performance.
your fight or flight systems are activated.
Right.
You're in that kind of, you know, fear state where you just really want something and you're afraid it's not going to happen and you're going to do everything you can to force it.
Right. And our thoughts create how we feel. Our feeling translates into actions, which impact the results that we get. And the results matter to a lot of us. So,
yeah. And yeah. I'll go one step further there. Not only is it the results that you're getting for whatever it is that you want in the moment, but also what I see with a lot of my patients now is it's your health. It's your long-term. You start to see changes in your physiology and inflammatory markers or metabolic markers or chronic diseases that come up because of being in that state for so long.
Definitely. That's huge. I'll certainly touch on some of that in a bit. But yeah. Then, so I transitioned from being like, yeah, that's perfectionist and really trying to force outcomes to having a drastic shift in identity. So what's interesting to me is how we all have desires that we want to accomplish, whether you're an athlete or not. And if your identity does not match the thing that you want, it's very unlikely that you're going to accomplish that thing. And so for me, it took a long period of time, and we're always a work in progress, right? So it took a long period of time. And while I was, you know, moving up in ranking, I hadn't quite identified with, so for us, the Olympic team is pulled from a World Cup team usually. And so I was just barely missing making the World Cup team multiple times. I mean, I was like, sometimes it was hundreds of seconds and I hadn't embodied that version of me. So there was a belief in me that felt that I was not quite worthy enough of competing at that level. So there's a disconnect between the desire that you want and the identity that you hold. I mean, imagine being a screwdriver trying to be a hammer. It's not fun. there's a lot of struggle there, right? So, and that's the type of struggle and experience that we have when our words, our thoughts, and our actions are not in alignment with our desires, because our identity leads our activity. So even if it's that thing that you want, so for me, it was to be on the World Cup team so that I could make an Olympic team. If your identity doesn't match that, you will end up having actions and activity that doesn't align with that. So whether that's a self-sabotaging thing or you just decide like, okay, my routines don't matter anymore. And I'm just not going to adhere to these things, or you make choices that are not in alignment with the thing that you want. And that has to do with the identity that you're holding. So for me, it was a really big shift in identity and reinforcing the self-talk and the belief to instill that. And I use that through self-talk and visualization and visualizing, this is me in this position on the World Cup team. This is me standing on the podium. And there's three explanations as to why visualization works. And it's there's bioinformational, which basically says that the brain can't distinguish between something that's real or imagined. Mm-hmm. And so if you, for example, if you've ever been told like, okay, close your eyes and imagine yourself biting into a lemon and you like actually sit there and think about it, you'll see people that like squint their eyes or pull their lips, purse their lips together. And, or if you are walking outside and you step on a stick, but you think it's a snake, you're going to jump. So your brain can't tell the difference between something that's real and imagined, because as you said, it's activating those same neural patterns as if you're actually executing that thing. And that reinforces that you're able to do that skill more effectively. So as Dr. Joe shares, you know, what fires together wires together. And another explanation is the functional equivalence explanation for visualization, which basically states the emotional aspect is the same. And then lastly, the mental readiness explanation. And that is that we are physically and emotionally prepared to do that thing, which I think was really helpful for me because it was like, it's familiar. Okay. I've been here before and I can do this. And so you're reinforcing that this is something that I can do, that I'm capable of doing. And that was really, really powerful for me. So I had visualized winning team trials. I had visualized when I set track records, I had visualized it multiple times. I saw even the times that I had gotten. And so that was like very, very powerful for me. And the key for that is being able to visualize that thing, yet have detachment from it. And when I was, so during the Olympic year, one of the reasons that I did not make an Olympic team is because I had a lot of attachment to like prior accomplishments and outcomes. And I was really attached to this worked for me before. And so it's going to work now. And I'm visualizing, and where is it? Like, where are these results? I'm not getting them. And so it's a really interesting, like optimal zone for an athlete to get into. And the mindset has to be aligned, but it's got to be like, I trust that this is going to happen. So it's a really interesting balance. So long story short, I've made that transition from this really perfectionist forcing outcomes and to visualizing and believing and having that identity shift, changing how I speak to myself and really conscious of the words that I'm using so that I just have a knowing that this is going to happen. And that was the transition that I had made.
Wow. And then a detachment from the outcome, knowing that you have a knowing, but then, you know, if it happens or it doesn't happen, it's not something that you're attached to. And that is, you know, you make it sound so simple and easy in telling us the story, but that is a lot of really hard work over many, many years. Definitely. And I think what you brought up about the identity part is so important, because even as you said, so much of it is maybe you want this thing really badly, but deep down you don't believe that you're good enough for it, or you don't believe you're worthy of it, as you said. Even if you visualize it, you're not going to have that same emotion in your body of you truly believing that that could be your reality. And that is a hard thing, I think, for all of us to work through. It's such a fundamental part of being a human and overcoming that sense of unworthiness. So I just love everything that you said. I think that it's, you know, you make it sound easy. It's not that easy, but it is so powerful.
Yeah, it's definitely a lot of introspective work, right? Because we absorb so much as children, and that is impressed on us, and we don't really know how to process that when we're young. Mm-hmm. And so it ends up impacting how we operate and the beliefs that we hold when we're adults. And so if you can take the time to go and unpack some of those stories and do so, I got connected through Mark England with you, And I'm doing the Enlifted method. And part of the things that we do there is story work and examining these old stories that we hold and getting them out of our brain and onto paper. And it is important because ultimately, like I said, that our thoughts and our beliefs, they impact our feelings. The words that we're saying impact our feelings, which impact our actions. And I believe when Mark was on the show, I think a year ago now, he talked about the reticular activating system. And that is what filters, it selectively filters information that aligns with all of that. It aligns with, like, for an athlete, for example, our goals, our desired performance state. And if you're thinking like, well, I'm just not worthy of that, that's the same sort of thing that you're going to continue to attract. And that could be for anything. Like, okay, if I consider myself to be an aspiring writer, well, I'm going to be in the state of aspiring for a while compared to the writer who impacts thousands of lives. Or if I'm trying to be healthy, for example, you're going to be in the state of being, of trying.
Right.
That's what you're going to be versus like, I am healthy and I eat healthy because I am healthy. So, and informing, like it requires that identity shift. And it ultimately comes down to examining what we want, why we want it. So our purpose, and why do we think the things that we think? And just making that shift. And like you said, it's an intrinsic work. It was not overnight for me.
No, it's not.
Took many years.
It's not. And I think the points you make are so important that most of this is not conscious, right? A lot of this is all, like you've mentioned, the ways that our nervous system is shaped through our experiences as children and the way that that impacts us, or the way that a subconscious belief about who we are or what we're capable of then impacts these micro decisions, these micro actions that we're not even aware of on a day-to-day basis. And so I think just understanding that so much of this is subconscious, and it's about training our nervous system through these different tools so that what's happening subconsciously is helping us and not hurting us. It's helping us get closer to our purpose, to our goals, to whatever that future reality is that we're striving for.
For sure. And I think, like, you made a really good point that we're not necessarily conscious of it. And our mindset, whether we know it or not, is at cause for our success and our failures. And since we don't recognize that, negation acknowledged, we then aren't using it consciously. And so that's kind of my role, is to help athletes or whoever, high performers, which we are all high performers, whether we know it or not.
Right. And sport is just a teacher for our life. So it all applies.
Exactly. Is to show that, to just unlock that and have that perspective shift that, like, you are at cause, and to shift from things aren't happening to me, they're happening through me. And just making the, I mean, it's small, it's incremental shifts that's consistency. Consistency is something that you do over time, and there's compound interest, and you'll see results. And so it's those small little shifts that start with the words that we're saying and what we're thinking about ourselves. And that's what mindset is. Mindset's what we think about ourselves. And it's really, really, can be scary work, but it's very, very powerful and can be really rewarding. And I think ultimately that's what I'm here to do, is to show people how powerful they really are. And there were times where I wish I had embodied that better.
Of course, that's how we learn.
So, but I think that there's a huge percentage of people that really don't know that at all. Right. They just have no idea how powerful they are. And which is crazy, because it's like, we are really, really,
we can tap into that.
We're all high performers, and we all have just this innate power within us.
So true. And you had the opportunity to put these tools into practice and to develop them in a really big way, because partway through your skeleton career, you went through a really difficult challenge. You were at the top of your sport and then everything changed. So can you talk about that experience?
Sure. So in 2012, I was about to go do a combine test, which is just an assessment of your strength and your agility, your speed. And I was having a really hard time breathing. So the 10 days or so before that, I had noticed in training that I just was taking a little bit longer to recover.
Okay.
And so I was like, that's really strange. And just having a little bit of like difficulty breathing. And I show up to this combine test. And the first, I couldn't even jog a lap around the track just to do some sort of a warm up. And so I'm like, okay, I guess I'm just going to go for this and with no warm up. All right, let's do this. And so the first thing is a 45 meter sprint, and you get three attempts at everything. So I do this 45 meters and I basically collapse on the side, and I'm struggling for breath. And so I'm there as a quote unquote veteran athlete. And I had recently just won the national championship. So, and there's new people here, and you know, they're looking at me like this girl won national championships. Like,
she's collapsed after one attempt.
You can't even do a 45 meter sprint. And I took one attempt at everything across the board, because I just could not even hold, couldn't catch my breath. So that was very scary. And so I end up finishing this combine. I somehow get the highest score of people who are doing combine a year. And that was like the strongest that I ever was. I was lifting so much. I still have not lifted as much as I did then at this combine test, which is wild. And so I'm like, what on earth is going on? And so I go to an urgent care and I'm like, listen, I cannot breathe. I can't have, like, I was literally having like such a labored conversation, could not catch my breath. And so at the time I had started a birth control, NuvaRing, and I started to have the difficulty breathing within 10 days of starting that. Wow. And when I went to, so I first went to an urgent care, and I was in Utah at the time. And I, you know, gave this whole backstory, and I'm like trying to give this doctor all the information they could possibly need. And so I'm like, you know, there were fires out here. One of my teammates had mono, but the one thing that I have changed personally is that I started this birth control. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really make the connection at the time. And they were like, well, I don't want to send you here with nothing. So they gave me an inhaler. They asked me if I wanted an epinephrine shot. Is that what it is? Adrenaline shot or something?
Yeah, an EpiPen.
Like, and I was like, no, I don't want that. So I leave, and I'm flying. At the time, my boyfriend was in Florida. So I flew from Utah to Florida. And while I'm there, I go see, and I walk into another urgent care, say the same thing. They give me an antibiotic because I think maybe I have an upper respiratory infection. Did a chest x-ray, didn't notice anything. Then I flew back from Florida to Connecticut. And if you know anything about blood clots, it's very dangerous to fly with blood clots. And I've used one of those like pulse ox, and it was, I mean, it was dropping. It was going towards 90. And so I'm like, this is really bad.
Good. Especially for the level of athlete that you were.
Yeah. So I had, you know, I called my mom and I'm like, I need you to get me into a pulmonologist as soon as I get back to Connecticut. There's something really wrong. I can't walk up the stairs without being totally out of breath. And I can't have a conversation. And so it feels like there's an elephant on my chest. And so I end up flying back to Connecticut again, long haul flight. And then I see this pulmonologist. I tell him the same exact story. And he's like, listen, this is really serious. And I hope that I'm wrong, but I need to rush you to get a CAT scan. And I think that you have you have blood clots in your lungs. And this is really, really serious. So it was like in the evening, had to go to this after hours imaging place, and they give me, I get a CAT scan, and an ultrasound in my legs. And so I'm sitting there in the ultrasound room and they bring in the phone because I had already had the CAT scan and it was the doctor. And he was like, Megan, you have multiple bilateral pulmonary embolisms and you have a big embolism off of the main branch of a pulmonary artery. It's wow. caused an infarction, and which basically means that the tissues died. And so I just immediately started bawling. And he's like, it wow. looks like somebody took paint splatter and went like this. And there's just blood clots all throughout your lungs. And so he's like, I'm sending an ambulance to come get you. They're going to go to bring you to the hospital. And so I went from training 6 days a week, sometimes twice a day, to being in the hospital. I was bedridden for 10 days. I was doing the heparin shots in my stomach. And
oh my goodness.
I had to use this little breathing device to increase my lung capacity. And then when I was released, I was allowed to walk for 10 minutes a day. So it was a wow. very big contrast, very drastic contrast from what I was used to. And then I was also taking Coumadin at the time. So this was in 2012. So Coumadin at the time was still being used as a blood thinner. And it's a very annoying blood thinner because you have to track your INR. So like the ratio to how your prothrombin time and to mm-hmm. see how thick the blood is. So your diet influences it and they adjust medication. I mean, I was in and out of the doctor's office 5 times a week, sometimes just trying to get the dosage right. Mm-hmm. And it was not very fun. And so I went, the pulmonologist was like, you know, you may never be an athlete ever again. You might have a blood clotting disorder. There's all of these things that we've got to look into. Mm-hmm. And so that was obviously really heartbreaking.
Devastating. Yeah.
Yeah. Just absolutely devastating. And it's really interesting. I mean, I can relate this to someone with a mental health issue. Like people can't see what's wrong with you. So mm-hmm. it was like, everybody was like, well, why aren't you competing? Like, what are you doing? You look fine. And mm-hmm. It was just really bizarre. And so while I took the advice and everything of my doctor, I, in my mind was like, that is not my reality. I'm going to return to competing. And mm-hmm. That was the vision that I had held. So they were like, you know, it's going to be at least a year that you're on blood thinners and could be longer if you have a blood clotting disorder. It could be for your life. And it turned out that I did not have a blood clotting disorder, which was great. And then mm-hmm. I had just kept visualizing my own healing and my own mm-hmm. recovery, like coming back from it. And I was constantly visualizing returning to skeleton. And so mm-hmm. they can't do a CAT scan too soon. And I was like, well, we're going to do one in 3 months, you know?
And then always pushing the envelope.
Yeah. They ended up letting me do that. And I wasn't cleared, but I was like visualizing that. I was like, I'm going to be cleared in record time. Right. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. so, it took about 8 months for me to be fully cleared off of blood thinners and everything.
Wow.
And it was definitely a struggle. It was very dark at times just to have that identity in crisis. Mm-hmm. And so now when I work with people, I would say, like for me, for example, skeleton is something I did. It's not who I am. It's just a part of who I am. Mm-hmm. And so being able to recognize, like, you have so much more to offer than this one sphere. And mm-hmm. it's tough as an athlete because your life is very out of balance.
Put everything into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's very, very different because there's a timeline on it. Like athletes usually aren't competing their entire life at the highest level. Like certainly we can do master's competitions and all of that, which I have mm-hmm. done, but the balance is very skewed for a bit. And that like everything, all of your energy is going into that. So it feels like your life is absolutely out of control when something like that is presented to you. So it was very powerful for me to focus on what I wanted and having that hope. And I think that that was instrumental in my healing, because had I been dwelling and ruminating and like, oh, poor me. And there were certainly times where that was the case, right? But I had to, for me, I had to come back to the fact like anything's possible. and I can get through this. And I know not everybody, it may be true for them. Maybe you wouldn't, like maybe you would have a blood clotting disorder, or you wouldn't be allowed to return to sports and you'd have to adjust. But I think that everything happens for a reason. And for me, it was to teach me to listen to my intuition, because my initial thought, I did not want to go on birth control. That's my personal feelings, was that this is not something that is good for me and good for my body. And so because that was what I was thinking, you know, it could have been a self-fulfilling prophecy, or it just could have been this lesson that was like, listen to your body. It knows. So,
yeah.
I knew it, like I did not want to go on it. I was very uneasy before even starting it. And so, that was like the biggest lesson for me, is that listen to your intuition and your body. You like your subconscious mind is so, so powerful. It's a supercomputer, and it knows, and it picks up on things that you don't consciously realize. And that was like the biggest thing that I took away from that experience.
That is beautiful. Wow. And I'm sure not the only thing. I'm sure so many, like you mentioned, having to work through the identity. I think it's one thing to say it, but then to actually experience it. I think the first time you experience some big adversity in sport, whether it's an injury that takes you out for a few games or a season, or something, you know, as drastic as what you went through, it really forces you to then have to, you know, deeply examine your identity and your connection to the things that you're doing and who you are beyond that sport, and using all of your tools. And that's incredible, the way that you use visualization and all these tools to come back and then be so successful again. And so now I know you've just recently, last year, I think, retired from skeleton. And so I know that you narrowly missed making the Olympic team again, but you also have a really beautiful, because you don't have the same attachment to the outcomes, you have a beautiful understanding of how you've processed and interpreted your career in skeleton. So can you share about that?
So at first, like obviously when I first did not make the Olympic team, it was very heartbreaking. And like human, I encourage people to feel your emotions. Like that's part of the human experience, right? You're here and it's not like I'm going to suppress this and pretend like it's not happening. Right. I really truly experienced the like heartbreak that came with not making an Olympic team.
And just because you're not attached doesn't mean that you don't feel those emotions, right? Like you still allow yourself to feel, and if you didn't feel anything, then that would be concerning, right? Because you'd probably be numbing things.
Yeah. And that for a bit was my purpose. Like I wanted to make this Olympic team. And so it feels like you fell short. That's very natural to feel that way. And it took a long time for me to really comprehend that this was a good thing. Like this, there's positive here. And I went through a lot. I mean, it was just a roller coaster, which is natural with any sort of like form of grief. It really is a form of grief. Mm-hmm. And so I had a lot of ups and downs, but I learned so much from my whole career. It was very challenging, very inspiring, enlightening for me. And I'm so, so grateful for the opportunity. And for me to not make an Olympic team showed me that I had to reflect and be like, I am successful. I was successful, and that I am still a successful athlete. And in Olympic sports, it's tough because it's like, it's once every 4 years is an Olympics. And that's, if you're listening to outsiders, that's the only thing that they know about, right? You're competing every season for the 4 years leading up to an Olympics. And so for an outsider, they're like, oh, okay. Like, what are you doing in a non-Olympic year? Well, I'm still training and I'm still competing.
Still competing, right?
So, and just to realize like everything that I did, all of the sacrifice, all of the training, it wasn't for nothing. And initially it did feel like that, right? There's this huge like, oh no. But I have taken away so much from that. And I've been able to reflect on it and realize that was my purpose. And I am, you know, in my limited human perspective, I do not know the full reason as to why I wasn't meant to be there, but I believe that I was not meant to be in China. And so whether that has to do with like, I'm in the military and there could have been other reasons like why I was not supposed to be there. I actually was able to be around for something that happened with my nieces. And so it was like, it really was like a divine intervention. And I think being able to have that perspective shift, whether that comes from you or you have someone else that helps you get to that perspective shift, it's really important. And just like everything in my mind, it's win or learn. You're just constantly learning, constantly growing and adapting and just progressing in this human experience. And I've learned a lot. And so I felt for a bit that I really didn't have a purpose. So it was like, cool, because I can go to the gym and I can just train until like look nice.
It's not rather, quite as exciting, right?
And I'm like, well, what am I actually doing here? So for me, I was like, this is like part, like I said, I came here to pursue something athletically. And so I transitioned into Olympic weightlifting just so I had a goal and something to work towards. And it also allowed me to put back into practice some of the things that made me successful, as well as continue to practice some of the things that I impart on athletes that I work with, which I think is really important because then you, it makes you more relatable if you're doing the thing that you're talking about. You know, you're walking the walk and not just talking the talk. That's super important. And I've gotten, you know, I've gone back to school full time for sports psych and I absolutely love it. I'm doing the unlifted certification. I'm in level two now. And yeah, it's that whole experience in skeleton has informed my mission moving forward. And it's just given me a lot of passion for the mindset stuff. And part of that is because like, I allowed my mindset to like falter in a way during that Olympic season. And I could have used the people that wanted to support me more. And I had felt like I've done all of this work, so I should know better. And I didn't want to like bother some of the sports psych or mental coaches I was working with because like we were different time zones and stuff. And I was like, oh, I don't want to bother them. It's like the middle of the night for them. But truly, like, I would like to impart on people that the people who are there to support you, they want you to utilize them and they want you to ask for their help when you need it. And that, like, they want you to be successful. And if they've helped you up to like this point, they certainly want to see you through to the finish line. Right. And so I use that now moving forward where I'm like, you can call or text me 24/7. I may not answer immediately because maybe I'm asleep, but I will get back to you. You are never bothering me, you know? And yeah, it's just, it's changed a lot of things. And even not to get too long-winded, but even competing in I competed in a master's weightlifting competition. I dropped 10 kilos for this competition.
Wow. And from starting from 120, that's pretty...
It was nuts. It was very significant. It was like wild. So, but I ended up winning. So I have a national champion title as a 49 kilo master's weightlifter. And the difference between like my Olympic season and this competition, granted, obviously there's different levels of commitment that were involved, but so I had did the same sort of things, a lot of self-talk, a lot of visualization going into the weightlifting competition. But the day of, I had initially been like, I'm going to lift 6 for 6. I'm going to make all my lifts and I'm going to be national champion and I'm going to lift this exact weight. And I think that's important. It's really important to have goals, you know, that sets the destination on your GPS, so to speak. But the day of, my intuition told me like, hey, you know what? You don't have to control every aspect of this, but like the main thing is that we want to be the national champion. And so I just, when my coach came to me and was like, you know, what do you want your attempts to be? I was like, this is what I think the opener should be. And then after that, I just trust you to make the decision for me. And so I didn't make 6 for 6 lifts and I did not make any PRs that day. But the goal was that I wanted to be a national champion. So if it's like, okay, what is it that you want? Mm-hmm. I want to win and I want to make sure I want to make all of my lifts. Well, the attention and energy goes into that like desperation that I mentioned before versus what do you want to become? Well, I want to be the national champion. And that creates expansion and there's opportunity there. And it, mm-hmm. it gives you the ability to detach from those outcomes mm-hmm. and knowing like micromanaging. Cause that's that in my Olympic season, I was so attached to outcomes and I need to place this high in this race and this. Mm-hmm. And that micromanaging again creates that resistance. It blocks those blessings and versus tapping into like, well, I want to be the national champion. That's how I know it's true. That's how I know this vision of mine is true is that mm-hmm. I'm the national champion. Does it matter? I could have failed, you know, two of my snatch attempts and two of my clean and jerks attempts and still made it and made the national champion. So the how doesn't necessarily matter. And that's another shift that I've made recently. And I think it's really, really powerful. And I share that with my athletes too.
So powerful. Oh my gosh. Everything you just said. And I think that's so important is understanding what is your true primary goal and then allowing it, listening to your intuition, allowing it to happen. Usually it's going to happen in a way that you least expect, right?
Definitely.
And the lesson that you mentioned too about asking for help, I think sometimes that is the first step that is so hard for us because again, that identity shift of, oh, I'm not worthy. I don't, you know, want to bother other people or burden other people. Yeah. But in reality, you know, we all, if anyone asked you for help, you'd be happy to help them, right? We all are here to help each other achieve our best, you know, purpose, our highest version of ourselves. And so I think those lessons are so beautiful. And also just hearing you talk about your career reminded me a lot of my experience in CrossFit, because it sounds like for you, so many of the wins and so many of the blessings were things that weren't what the external world would necessarily see, right? You know, most of the world, like you said, just sees the Olympics. They don't see all the other things that you accomplished when you came back from the blood clots and the world championship teams or world teams or what, all those other things. They didn't see the way that you were able to grow your mindset from skeleton to Olympic weightlifting. And for me, I think that was very similar. In my last season of CrossFit ended by tearing my Achilles. So I didn't get to compete in the CrossFit Games, even though it was the fittest I'd ever been. My mindset was stronger than it had ever been. I really felt like I was capable of winning. But in that same season, I also had met certain milestones in training that nobody else saw that I'd been chasing for years. And that was super fulfilling, overcome mental challenges and all kinds of things that nobody else sees. And so I think it puts in perspective that it really is about the process and it's about your own personal growth and then your story that you get to share with the world. It doesn't always have to be about winning, and maybe you're able to help more people now through the experience that you had and through the ways that you're coaching and sharing your experience than you ever would if you had made the Olympic team. You never know.
I agree. And I think that for the most part, not everybody is pursuing an Olympic medal or an mm-hmm. Olympic team. And so I think that also makes me a little bit more relatable. Not that Olympic medalists aren't, but it's like, I understand what it's like to fail at the highest level and also have really great success at the highest level and mm-hmm. developmental level. Like, you know, I feel like I have experienced the vast ways to mm-hmm. win and lose, which is good. And I mean, it's informed me so much. And I think it makes me a better coach for other people.
I love that. And to be able to to not let those things define you, right? To be able to say, oh, I failed at the highest level, but that doesn't define me. And I'm able to understand how that plays into the bigger purpose of my life and now use that to help other people instead of letting it define the rest of your life. Like, oh, I'm a failure.
Which definitely.
So many of us can get stuck in from different challenges that we experience. So just beautiful. It reminds me also a lot of, I recently interviewed Dr. Lisa Miller on the Science of Spirituality, and she talks about this red door and yellow door analogy. And so it just makes me think about that. Like when you're trying to force open this red door of the way that you want things to be, sometimes if you just relax and look around and see, oh, there's another door here, and maybe that's even better. And you talking about some of the blessings that came out of you not being in China, being able to appreciate those because you're you're open to them and looking for them.
Yeah, definitely. And we, again, like we can choose what story we're telling, you know, like I could have easily been doom and gloom and stayed there. And like you said, identified with being a quote unquote failure. I chose to tell a different story. I chose to tell a different story when I had blood clots. And we have that power. Our subconscious mind is, it's like a garden, right? You plant the seed and whatever one that you're watering, that's what's going to grow. And I think what's closest to us is what we can influence most rapidly. And so that comes down to our thoughts and our words, and ultimately those impact our behaviors and our actions. And so like the faster that you can change that story, then the faster your experience will change. And for me, that was how I was able to do that, is to shift my identity and then shift into like appreciation for that whole experience, and just like being present with the gratitude and with the grief. Like there certainly was grief there. But being able to transmute that into like, you know, I have a really awesome opportunity now to serve others in a way that I might not have had I made the Olympic team.
Mm-hmm. So beautiful. So beautiful. Well, I want to wrap up with three questions that I ask everyone at the end of the podcast, and then learn more about where people can find you and work with you. So the first one is, what are the three things that you do on a regular basis that have the biggest positive impact on your health?
Ooh, this is awesome. Okay. I would still say meditation. That's like my number one.
Must do. Yeah. Same here.
I firmly believe in self-care and recovery. So I personally like getting massages and just also disconnecting from devices in general. I think that's really, really huge. We've just never been at a time in existence when our attention is on a device from could be from the moment you wake up till you go to sleep. So making that time, like the separation from devices, I guess that would be the third. But so it'd be meditation, the self-care, really prioritizing self-care so that you can show up fully in your life with the things that you want, and part of, you know, work-life balance, having that life balance, and then disconnecting, being able to disconnect. And even with meditation, like having time for you and just yourself, and being able to know thyself. I think those are my three, big three.
Love it. What is one thing that you think would have a big impact on your health, but you have a hard time implementing it, or something you're working on?
Oh, cold showers.
Oh yeah. Same here. It's hard for me to
wrap my head around that.
Yeah.
I mean, I've done like, you know, I might start or end my showers with like 10 to 30 seconds, but
sure.
I have never really been that great with cold. So
even on the skeleton track.
Honestly, everybody's like, I'll wear a sweatshirt in the summertime. So people are like, my parents in particular, like, how did you do skeleton cold all the time? Yeah. Ice baths for sure. And implementing breath work more consistently. Mm-hmm. I think that's also a really, really powerful one that I've dipped my toes into, and I am implementing starting today.
I love it. All right. Last question is, what does a healthy life look like to you, Megan?
A balanced life, a balanced and happy life. I think for a long time, like I said, the balance was not there. And so I think having opportunity. So for me, moving forward, I want to be able to pursue things that bring me joy. I think that is super important, versus feeling like, well, I need to stay in this job because I've got nothing else. Well, no, you are the creator, and you can create whatever opportunities that you believe in. And it's just a matter of like taking that step. So I think having a work-life balance, but ultimately just consistently pursuing things that bring you joy. For me, that's travel, that's spending time with family, and also learning about the mind.
I love that. Well, it's so beautiful just to hear you. You have such a light and an ease when you're talking. And I can only imagine if I had met you 10 or 15 years ago that it would have been a very different experience because I could just see. And I think with me too, I think back to who I was when I was competing in CrossFit and I was very also shy. I was very sort of like uptight and trying to control every aspect. And there's just such a beautiful thing about taking all the best parts of yourself that allowed you to be, you know, competitive and an athlete and successful, but also then growing and having some sense of letting go and surrender to whatever the bigger plan is. So I just have loved it. Really enjoyed talking with you. And before we go, well, I know people can find you on your Instagram at the Savage Meglet. And so you have to tell us the backstory behind that name and then where else people can find you or work with you.
So I was given that nickname because of just, I've had a lot of, like you said, like I started out being like this really gritty and resilient person, which I still am. I'm still gritty and resilient.
Of course.
I still have that almost that underdog energy that I brought to competing. So it comes from that and Meglet because I'm small. So Meglet, it's like a piglet. You're just small, a small version. So just being like small in stature, but still being able to have that power and that grit, resilience, determination, all of those verbs.
I love it. I love it. And is there anywhere else that people can learn more about how to work with you or anything that you're up to, or is that the main place?
So website is under construction, but you can email me at megan@thesavagemeglet.com. And I am the Savage Meglet on all social media channels. And if you're interested, just shoot me a DM, ask me any question anytime. I'd love to answer.
Love it. Awesome. Thank you so much, Megan. This has been great.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for tuning in. If you enjoy listening to the podcast, please consider subscribing and giving it a 5-star rating on iTunes. It really does help to get the word out to more people.